Welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show's Tech Tuesday, keeping you on the cutting edge of the tech revolution from WAMU 88.5 FM in Washington. Six.
From WAMU at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. Imagine a thinner you, a you with a mohawk, or a you with a certain tattoo that you've always secretly coveted. Imagine living deep in a vast forest, or in a sprawling mansion, or in a 60s-style commune. Not all of these things may be possible in our everyday lives, but they are possible in the growing number of virtual worlds cropping up on the Internet. In virtual worlds, 3D versions of ourselves can interact with other 3D people known as avatars. Millions of people are exploring virtual worlds, which are being called the next step beyond email and instant messaging. And some observers say that virtual worlds raise new economic and legal questions as people make real money while interacting in virtual realms. In other words, commerce in places that don't exist over items that don't really exist in tangible currency. Joining us now to discuss virtual worlds and avatars is Philip Rosedale. He is founder and CEO of Linden Lab. That's the company that developed the 3D virtual world SecondLife.com. He joins us from studios at KQED in San Francisco. Philip Rosedale, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Also with us is Edward Castronova, who is Associate Professor of Telecommunications at Indiana University and author of the book Synthetic Worlds, The Business and Culture of Online Games. He joins us from studios at WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. Edward Castronova, welcome.
Thanks, Kojo. Great to be here.
We invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 800-433-8850. Do you live in a virtual world, or do you visit the virtual world that you've created, or have you never even heard of this? Call us, 800-433-8850, or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Philip, the virtual world that you created has been described as a cross between an internet chat room and an unscripted movie set. For those of our listeners who have never visited a virtual world before, could you explain, describe what your virtual world looks like?
Sure. I think one of the things that's so interesting about virtual worlds nowadays, that is with the technology that exists now, is that for the most part, they look and feel and are a lot like the real world. So Second Life is a virtual world which has real estate and it has weather, and you walk into it with a body, and you can reach out and touch things and make things. If you want to buy a house and then go shopping to find furniture to decorate it, you do those things, and you do them pretty much the same way you might imagine doing them in the real world. And to get the money, as you touched on earlier, Kojo, to buy that furniture, you can just exchange currency into Linden dollars, in the case of Second Life, using U.S. dollars. So it's pretty normal nowadays.
Edward Castronova, the 3D people who frequent virtual worlds are called avatars, but avatars can also be animals or other creatures. How would you define an avatar?
Well, really, it's, that comes from Hindu culture, the idea being that the avatar is the instantiation or the physical appearance of some god on the earth. Okay, so that's the origin of the term.
Yeah, that would be me, but all right.
Yeah. what god are you? So in the context of these video games, your avatar is really a video game character. It's the body in the virtual world that holds your soul. And the cool thing about that is, well, you can take any body that you want. You could take an animal or a machine, anything you want. You have a lot of freedom.
Philip, do people tend to create avatars who look like their real selves, or are they more often fantasy alternatives?
That's a really great question. I think about half the time when we jump into a place like Second Life, your first idea is to make yourself as realistically as you can, and you can do that. You can get pretty close to yourself. But I think where people tend to go is once they've tried that and tuned themselves maybe a little bit away from exactly what they are in real life, I'd say about half of them go in a different direction altogether, like Ted was talking about.
I know both of you have avatars. Let me go to you, Edward or Ted. Can you tell us what your avatars look like and why you chose the ones that you did?
Well, gee, the avatar I'm playing right now is kind of a John the Baptist type. Very, very old, gray-haired, crazy guy who can't hear or speak. That's my choice, and he's a healer sort of person. So, you know, you imagine, oh, you know, it's a video game, so the things that you do is you go and you kill orcs. And actually, that's not true. This guy's a priest. All he does is go around helping people and healing them. And in Philip's world, actually, to my knowledge, there are no orcs whatsoever. And the point of Second Life is not actually to play out some sort of video game image that people might have. Actually, Second Life is about users creating content. So you go into Second Life and you you might make a house or a car or a motorcycle or an airplane. And any one of those, you can also model your avatar in a number of different ways. But at the moment, I'm playing a healer, but there's a wide palette of opportunities out there.
But I have heard, reliable sources have informed me, that you, Edward, have another avatar.
Yes, I have many.
A beautiful woman.
I mean, it's very common for people to have a palette, or a portfolio of characters, and I don't hesitate at all to explore. And I don't believe I'm gender confused, so let me just put that little disclaimer up at the front of my statements. But it's amazingly easy to explore different aspects of your own personality and different aspects of society and the way that society reacts to you. And so, for example, yes, I've played a beautiful woman, and it's really, really interesting to go into the virtual world as, you know, having the body of a beautiful young lady for a middle-aged guy. I'm not going to say that I understand everything about what it's like to be a woman, but I think I understand it a little bit better.
Tell us about your avatar, Philip.
Well, my avatar...
Or do you two have a portfolio of avatars?
You know, I actually only have one, but I think in my case it's because it's been so much fun to be a well-known person in the world. So I have to admit it's a little tempting to always be Philip Linden, which is the name that I have in Second Life. We all have the last name Linden, so we're the people who work at the company, we're kind of like the Ramones or something in the world of Second Life. And my avatar, in real life I have blonde hair and blue eyes, and my avatar is a kind of a shorter, quite a bit shorter than me, and spiky brown hair and big handlebar mustache kind of look, you know, bumping his nose. Very, very different than I look. But it is a guy.
How do people respond to your online alter ego, Philip?
Well, you know, I think that the thing that's so fascinating about these virtual worlds as they become more and more possible and more populated is that this feeling of interacting with people, of bumping into somebody accidentally, say, as you walk by them or the first time you speak to them, it's just a feeling that you really have to try. It has an unusual set of properties. You feel at once kind of closer to people quickly when you meet them. And then, as we've been talking about, you also have this tremendous ability to project your identity and potentially be something you're not. Although I would add that I think most people in Second Life do tend to play, for example, to create characters that are their own gender. And so I think that comes from the fact that it's a little difficult to be something completely that you're not, even when you're in a virtual world.
What do people's responses at Edward tell us about society outside the internet?
So you mean just folks on the street? Like when I'm at a wedding, for example, and people are like, well, what do you do? I'm an economist. Well, what sort of stuff do you study? They want stock market recommendations, things like that. So, well, I study the economies in video games. And it's usually, people are usually kind of shocked that this is going on at all. But then when you explain what the nature of the technology is and what it allows, a lot of times people say, wow, I better not get involved with that because I'll just spend all my time there. It sounds like it's so much fun. So the reaction of people on the street is sort of a mixture between some people immediately see this as having long-run implications, the idea that there are fantasy worlds being built to suit the dreams of all human beings, and that this there's a huge industry now that's devoted to just making that. So it has this long-run implication. Some people just jump right on that in their area of business, journalism, whatever it is. It's like, oh, my gosh, this is an important thing. Other people sort of scowl up their face and they say, no, it's never going to happen. Bah, humbug. And other folks are kind of just laid back and think, wow, this is going to be fun to watch. So I've heard, you know, one really common problem or statement that I hear from people that is sort of from a problematic point of view is parents are deeply concerned. You know, they already see their kids sort of playing video games a lot. And then I say, well, you know, there are games that are on 24/7 filled with a huge society. They can live as, you know, starship captains. And it's like, how am I going to get my kid to do any of his homework? So I think just basically, you know, the broader implication is that we're going to have a discussion, I think, pretty soon around the world, not just in this country, but around the world about dealing with this technology. I think it's kind of coming on us pretty quickly.
Indeed. Let's go to the phones, starting with Trinity in San Diego, California. Trinity, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. I am a resident of Second Life, and I just wanted to say that I absolutely love it, first of all, and Philip's done a great job putting this together. But, Philip, I know that you have more than one avatar, and you didn't come out with the fact that you have a female.
You know, gosh, look at that.
You notice I'm not saying a word.
That's right. That's right.
Better to come clean in the public eye, Philip.
Yeah, one of the people at work built the most amazing female avatar very early on. That's a great memory, a couple of years ago. And when I do demonstrations where I want to show off Second Life, sometimes if I'm showing somebody all the things you can do or clothes you can wear, it's easier to do that with a female avatar. And you're absolutely right. So I do have one that I wear with a great, great big tattoo actually on her face. So it's a very exotic look that I use for demonstrations. Thank you. That's right, Trinity.
Trinity, thank you for being in the audience and keeping us all honest.
Thank you.
Trinity, thank you very much for your call. You too can call us 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. You know, Philip, I've heard that interacting in a virtual world can be a lot more intense than traditional instant messaging and email. Is that true? And if so, why?
Absolutely, for a lot of reasons. In fact, I have to smile there at that last question, because one of the things about identity is you really do think of yourself as being projected into your avatar. And in the case of that avatar that Trinity mentioned, I really don't, because I kind of only use it for demonstrations. And so I actually don't think of it as being me, which was the thought that I just had there in being asked that question. Interaction between people can be more intense for a lot of reasons. One of them I would call this kind of gateway or barrier lowering that happens when we interact through the medium of the computer. Because we're not making eye contact with each other and because we're not physically close to each other, there is a lot of risk that's removed from interaction. And so people tend to get closer to each other faster, to tell each other things that they might not tell each other on first meeting on the street, or to ask advice, for example, walk up to someone very beautiful that would be attractive to you and ask them a question about what's going on, what do I do next. Those are things that we are often hesitant to do in real life, and you will find that they're quite easy to do in the virtual environment. The other thing I'd say is that remember that the technology of these new worlds is such that you are able to, in a very rich way, express yourself. So if you want to build, almost like an Iron Chef contest or something, if you want to build me something quickly that shows me how you're feeling, you know, sculpt something, you can literally do that in an environment like Second Life. And so the richness of communication, what you're wearing, what you own, where your house is, who your neighbors are, these things are part of communication. And so the channels for communication are very, very rich in these environments.
Edward, online games have been around since the late 1980s, but Philip has been quoted as saying that with Second Life, you're not building a game, but a new country. Is that, Edward, what makes today's virtual worlds different?
Well, not all of them. I think what Second Life is doing is truly revolutionary. Okay, so to paraphrase Philip, and not to take the words out of his mouth, but I think what he's getting at is the fact that this same communications technology, which is used primarily right now to make games, so a big, say, fantasy environment, as I said before, with orcs and so on, if you just peel away the game part and just leave the technology and let the users sort of make of it what they will, then you are making a country. So imagine that, you know, you have the basic technology of, well, we have a character and there's geography. So there's land, there's sea, there's islands. And we have a production technology that allows us to take the resources of the system and to build things. It's not really a game at that point, right? That's just a bunch of people making stuff. They can make games with those tools, but it's really what it is. It's an alternative space. It's just another place for human beings to interact. And that's what Second Life is doing. You know, the other applications of the technology are coming out of the video game industry, but I don't think that's the only application. And so that, I think Philip is right to say that what we're seeing here is not necessarily the expansion of let's say, games into everyday life, but a new platform for humanity to sort of play out its ancient dramas.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on virtual worlds and avatars. You can join it by calling 800-433-8850 with your questions or comments. Or if the lines are busy, send us an email to Kojo, K-O-J-O, at WAMU.org. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. I'm Kojo Nandi.
This is a WAMU Community Minute recognizing December as National Drunk and Drug Driving Prevention Month.
Designated drivers are the keys to a safe holiday season. Party hosts should offer non-alcoholic beverages and remind guests to designate a driver.
RAP's Sober Ride of Washington, D.C. will provide free rides to intoxicated people between 8 p.m. and 4 a.m. from December 12th through New Year's Day.
Local meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous provide support for people who want to stop drinking. D.C. area groups meet throughout the week.
Mothers Against Drunk Driving of Northern Virginia offers a free victim support group for anyone who's been injured or lost a loved one in a drunk driving crash.
Al-Anon and Alateen chapters in the D.C. area offer support groups for people who are affected by others drinking. Meetings are available for people of all ages.
The D.C. area Narcotics Anonymous holds more than 100 meetings weekly to help recovering addicts. To review these safety tips and to find more information about support groups, visit our website, WAMU.org. Click on Calendar and take action in your community.
Hi, everybody. This is Ed Walker. And you know, Christmas Eve Recollections has become a tradition here at WAMU. And this year, we get an extra hour. We're on from 7 till midnight with Jack Benny as Santa Claus on The Phil Harris Show. We'll also have Fibber McGee and Molly. And we'll have Lionel Barrymore as Ebenezer Scrooge and much, much more. So plan to gather around the radio with your family and join me, Ed Walker, Christmas Eve, 7 to midnight at 88.5 FM, WAMU.
Welcome back. We're talking with Philip Rosedale, founder and CEO of Linden Lab, the company that developed the 3D virtual world SecondLife.com, and Edward Castronova. He's an associate professor of telecommunications at Indiana University and author of the book Synthetic Worlds, The Business and Culture of Online Games. We're talking about virtual worlds and avatars. Let's go to John in Washington on the telephone. John, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Good morning, Kojo. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thanks for calling.
Philip had brought up a point that parents are concerned that, you know, where would their kids find time to do their homework, and I'd wondered if anybody had ever explored educational type of environment using the same avatar online world technology, and maybe you guys could talk about that.
Philip?
Absolutely. We at present have, I think, several dozen universities actually beginning to explore a number of different educational ways of using Second Life. That's a great question. And in general, the ability to make things in a virtual world, you can imagine, leads to a lot of educational possibilities. So if you want to make a big Rube Goldberg device, you know, that teaches you the principles of physics and, you know, has, you know, balls rolling down things, or you want to do a little sociology or anthropology, reconstruct the history of something, you can do that fairly easily. So there are a lot of educational opportunities. The other point, and we touched on that briefly before about kids and, you know, is it good for kids to be in these worlds, is, well, it depends on what they're doing. You know, Second Life presents you with a lot of challenges, like starting your own business, that feel a lot, I think, like, you know, having a lemonade stand as a kid. As Ted said, you can also spend all your time killing monsters and just kind of idly clicking on the mouse. And I suppose if you're doing that, you might spend some extra time on it.
But I understand that virtual worlds are being used to help people with disorders like Asperger's syndrome. How so?
Well, in the example of Asperger's, there was a particular experiment in Second Life, which you might be referring to, in which a guy took a group of people from an online web community that were suffering Asperger's, and he
which means they have difficulty with face-to-face social interaction. Go ahead, please.
That's right. That's right. And he gave them an island in Second Life, which was initially a sort of a little private island off the coast of Second Life. And he said, why don't you hang around in some public spaces that I've built for you on this island, you know, and get comfortable interacting with each other face to face. And then once you've done that, wander off the island and go to, as we say, the mainland, where there are lots and lots of different people, and try interacting with them. And I think a year or so now into that experiment, a number of the folks who participated report that they do find it easier to interact, both in Second Life and then as a result of that interaction, in the real world. And I think that, again, the degree to which we're getting closer and closer to real life in the way this technology feels is what makes things like that example possible.
Now on to the...
If you don't mind if I jump onto that question about the education and the technology, I guess my response to the woman at the cocktail party or at the wedding who's concerned about this, I say, as a teacher, I know that technology, and not just virtual world technology, but the communications technology in general, is really threatening what we consider acceptable practice in education. You know, it's really, really hard to get students to just sit in a room and listen to a guy talk for an hour. And I think they're justified in that because a technology has emerged that allows way more interaction, way more productivity, just in general, just the internet and communications tech. So virtual worlds have, you know, clear implications for like immersing people in history and in faraway places. But I'd like to make a pitch for education not of students but of scholars and researchers. Can you imagine what the kind of social science experiments you could run if you had – a large virtual world with hundreds of thousands of ordinary people participating in it.
And this, you need to know, is what Edward Castronova in very many ways specializes in. He's a professor of telecommunications at Indiana University. Go ahead, because this is fascinating.
Yeah, well, I mean, you put me on a show. It's a technology show in Washington, D.C. The opportunities for policy experiments, for example. You say you want to change how pollution permits are traded. And you're really afraid of taking that to Congress without having some prediction about how it's going to work. Right now, you have no opportunity to actually run an experiment other than to say, you know, go to Ohio and change how the rules are, which is really expensive, really dangerous politically. But here you could actually set up a virtual world in something like Second Life, set up a system where there's tradable permits, get some economists involved, change the parameters under which these things are traded, and then actually see how things change. It's an unprecedented opportunity for human beings to do macro-level social experiments, and it's just something that falls right out of the technology. It's off the shelf right now.
And in a way, it's an avenue for us to back into the economics aspects of this discussion, because the argument that people would make with you, Edward, is how do you know that people who are involved in virtual worlds are reflective of the community at large? The people who are involved in virtual worlds may fall into specific demographic groups that may not be truly reflective of how the overall people who live in the real world might act in the same economic environment.
Well, you know, Koju, I wonder how many of your listeners know that the modal, that is the most frequent demographic category in online games in general, are 40-plus-year-old women. You know, you tend to think of video games as, well, you know, it's a pimply-faced kid in his mom's basement. And that's not the way it is anymore. There are lots of people playing online games like checkers at the Yahoo Games site. And we get a lot of attention in the media from games like World of Warcraft, which is primarily for mostly guys, some women, but mostly guys between age like 18 and 30. But, you know, Philip can tell you about the demographics of Second Life. They're not like that at all. And so my response is that the demographics are produced by the game design. If you want to do a test on a certain subpopulation, design the right game and you'll get them.
40 women 40 years and older, huh? My sister wouldn't let me play in her dollhouse either. I wonder how she would treat me in her virtual world.
But I mean, Philip, seriously, what are the demographics of Second Life right now? Do you have any recent data on that?
Absolutely. You know, more than half of the user base of Second Life, I think about 55% are between the ages of 25 and 44, As you said, there are many more people in their 30s, 40s, 50s that are perhaps the most active and engaged and entrepreneurial or landowning sort of participants. There's also a significantly greater number of women in Second Life. Women tend to use Second Life a little bit more on an hours basis. So if you just walk up to somebody in world and begin talking to them, the chances as to whether they're really male or female are close to 50-50 in terms of usage time.
I understand that people are spending $3 million a month at Second Life alone. What are they buying, Philip?
And the important thing to point out is that $3 million is purely money that's being exchanged between them for goods and services. So what they're buying is houses and clothing and services like architectural services. You might buy a beautiful plot of land overlooking the water on a hill and then want to build a house. Well, you can build that house from scratch yourself if you like, and it's very fun, much more fun than in the real world. But the quality of houses is a competitive market in Second Life. And so, you know, if you really want a great one, you're probably going to go out and hire an architect. So that's an example of a service. People run entertainment experiences like games or nightclubs or dancing lessons or things like that. And those are things they also charge for. But all told, about $3 million U.S. in transactions now per month.
And how does the actual transaction take place in a virtual world, Edward?
Well, it's the same way it does on eBay. So let's say I buy a Hummel figurine from you, Kojo, on eBay. You wait for the check. I write you a check in U.S. dollars, and then you have to deliver the figurine, right? So you put it in a box and you send it to me. If I was to buy a virtual Hummel figurine from you in Second Life, basically I would somehow give you the real money, and then your character and my character would meet up inside Second Life, and we would exchange. And I don't know, Philip, if Second Life has this, but a lot of these games, they actually have a mail system inside the game, so you could mail the virtual figurine to me as well. It's really no different from real-world eBay.
That's right, and I think one of the most important things about the economy and why, on a per-user, per-capita basis, the Second Life economy is so large, even larger, I think, from a discretionary spending perspective than the real world, the ease with which you can give somebody else money is a big element in this. Just as Ted said, you can hand something to somebody at a distance by kind of mailing it to them, or you can just walk up to somebody, click on them, and say, I want to give you $10. Or you can walk up to an object in world that is its own kind of vending machine and just buy a copy of it right then, and you just get it into your inventory and you can then use it.
Joining us now is Chip Matthews. He's a freelance animator who sells custom-made skin and clothing to people for their avatars. Chip, welcome.
Thank you.
How did you get involved in this business?
Because I'm an animator by trade, I'm, of course, interested in any place where I can apply my skills. And I had read an article about Second Life, which at the time was going to be called Lindenworld, about a year before it became available to the public. And because of its collaborative building nature, I just immediately knew that that was something that appealed to me as something I'd like to get involved in. So when I had the opportunity, I did. And I originally started making things just for the fun, the pure joy of creating. But as more and more people got to know my goods and started buying them, and it became possible to convert Linden dollars to real dollars, it actually became a fairly substantial second income and makes it a lot easier to justify the amount of time that I spend in the virtual world.
Why do people need custom skins for the avatars?
I think it all comes down to self-expression. The default skins are a little plain, cartoony, and they don't do a whole lot to differentiate one person from the next. And I think one of the giant appeals for people is just the ability to become their ideal self or to express themselves in some way that goes, you know, far beyond how they're able to in the real world. So what designers like myself are able to do is just provide a lot more opportunities for people to accessorize and create their ideal self.
Where were you when Michael Jackson needed you? What are some of the more common requests from your customers, Chip?
I do get quite a few requests from people who would like to have sort of an exact replica of them, of their real world selves. I don't tend to do a lot of custom work just because, to me, that starts to feel a little bit too much like my real job and doing things on deadlines for clients. I prefer to just make products and put them out there, and those who like them buy them, and those who don't, don't.
How much will I have to pay if I want a custom-made skin or a custom-made piece of clothing?
My skins sell for $4,000 Linden, which at the average exchange rate would be around $15 or $16 US.
Whoa. And that exchange rate, Edward Castronova, is, I guess, higher than the exchange rate for the yen or other real currencies.
Oh, I don't know if I can do math on the air, but there are, what is that, 4,000 divided by 15? Let's whip out our calculators.
250 to 1 right now.
250 to 1. Okay, so that beats the South Korean won, which is about 1,000 to 1. The yen is about 120. And the point is, it's not even that oil is higher or lower. The point is that the exchange exists. It's supported by a robust market. And virtually every one of these synthetic worlds, you know, they almost always have an economy in them. They almost always have a currency in them, which is also, that by itself is a little bit strange. You wouldn't think that the economy would add to fun, but it turns out, yeah, people want economies in their games. And then as soon as the economy and the currency show up, people start trading it with or without the sanction of the developers, and you get these robust, stable exchange rate markets. Those markets are maybe the best and most convincing evidence that the economic activity inside these places is real. So the dragons and the houses and so on, they sort of look like they don't exist. They look like they're fantasy. But in terms of their economic value, it's as real as the economic value of the Hope Diamond or NPR.org.
As I said earlier, commerce in places that don't exist over items that don't really exist. Intangible currency. I can't say what a country, what a world, because this is...
Yeah, well, you know, when you said that, I sort of cringed because I thought, well, NPR.org doesn't exist in some sense. I can't hold on to www.npr.org, but if you think it has no value, I want you guys to just give it to me for free.
Oh, we're not saying it has no value at all. It may not exist in the real world, but it clearly has significant value.
I do think that's... You know, can I jump in here for a second? I think that's a bit of a misnomer in that you can go buy yourself an audio CD, and unless you're in the specific context of inserting it into your CD player, it's really not useful for anything. And I think the same is true of virtual goods within these worlds, within the context where they're useful. They are very useful to people, and they do accentuate the experience.
And they are entertainment. It's like going to see a movie that you're not in. You nevertheless pay to go see it because during the time you're in that space, it's entertaining and you feel you're a part of it.
Well, you guys talk about how value is created. I just wanted to add, you know, Chip's ability to sell his skins for $16 U.S. roughly. Is a result of Chip's skill and his resultant fame in Second Life. He'd probably be shy to tell us, but he's a very well-known creator of skins and clothing in Second Life, and as a result is able to charge a proportionately greater amount for those for their quality. And so it's entirely possible with work to become famous and become successful in these worlds. And
Chip, is this something that you'd consider doing on a full-time basis?
Sure, absolutely. Okay. It's fun, and I get to work at home, you know, which can't really complain about that, especially in a big city like D.C. And one thing that appeals to me greatly is the work that I do for my real-world clients. Usually the best compliment that I'll get back from them is not to hear from them until the next time they need something. Whereas the things that I do for Second Life, I get to see people really sort of connect to those things and enjoy them. And I'll be out wandering around the world and see people wearing or using my creations. And that's really satisfying to me in a way that I don't get in the same degree from my normal job.
Here's Peter in Fairfax, Virginia. Peter, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking the call, Kojo. Appreciate it. In terms of investments in this market, it seems to me that a lot of the kind of cutting-edge organizations that are developing this type of technology are being bought out by larger developers like EA Sports buying out Blizzard for World of Warcraft. Do you guys have in mind any smaller organizations that are really contributing to this that could be investment opportunities?
Linden Labs would be a fine.
Fine investment opportunity.
Yeah.
But, Philip, if there's so much money to be had, why isn't Linden Labs trying to get a bigger piece of the action?
That's a great question. Look at the early days of the growth of these types of pioneering economic communities, and you see environments where you've got to stay out of the way to let them grow. I think that I wouldn't move to another country that had a sales tax rate of 15%. In fact, you know, countries that are trying to attract people to move there generally forego taxation for the first few years or things like that to invite people to be there. I think that we, as creators of virtual worlds, compete with the real world in a very real way. We need to offer something better. And an example of better is a reasonable freedom from lots and lots of taxation. And so that was something that we tried to do pretty aggressively as we started out with Second Life.
Peter, thank you very much for your call. Chip, have you noticed that the market for your services has changed since you first got into this? Is there more competition these days?
Oh, absolutely. I was lucky in that I got in very early on. In fact, I think I was the first person to sort of turn making alternate skins into a business. So it was very lucrative there for quite a while because I'm sort of riding the crest of that wave. And now there's probably, you know, 20 or 30 other people out there competing with me, which, you know, while I don't make as much money as I once did, I personally love that because it's inspiring to me to see what other people do. And, it will spur me to go in whole different directions that I might not otherwise have thought of.
Chip Matthews is a freelance animator who sells custom-made skin and clothing to people for their avatars. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more of this conversation and your telephone calls. If you've called already, stay on the line on Virtual Worlds and Avatars. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, members of Metro's new Riders Advisory Council take your tips for improving mass transit. Plus, with snow falling in the Himalayas and thousands of lives at risk, we find out how Pakistan's earthquake survivors are faring. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5 FM.
And then at 2 o'clock on Talk of the Nation here on WAMU, as healthcare costs go up, governors are stepping in with their own ideas about how to cover more people while spending less. In Florida, private companies will have a bigger role in running Medicaid. Massachusetts may mandate some people to buy their own plan. States and healthcare, that's Talk of the Nation at 2 o'clock on WAMU 88.5 FM. If you enjoy going out to dinner, don't forget to bring your WAMU member card. Simply present it for two-for-one entrees at more than 300 restaurants in the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia. You'll also receive discounts at bed and breakfasts, online retailers, and area attractions. You can learn more about the WAMU member card by calling 800-248-8850 or by going online to wamu.org.
Support for WAMU comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, the Siegel Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
It's currently 36 degrees in northwest Washington. Our forecast through the afternoon, sunny skies, high temperatures expected to remain in the upper 30s. Tonight, mostly clear and cold, with lows in the lower 20s downtown and lows between 15 and 20 in the suburbs. And now at 12:44, we return to the Kojo Nandi Show here on WAMU 88.5 FM.
Welcome back. We're talking about virtual worlds and avatars with Philip Rosedale, founder and CEO of Linden Lab, which developed the 3D virtual world SecondLife.com. Edward Castronova is a professor of telecommunications at Indiana University and author of the book Synthetic Worlds, The Business and Culture of Online Games. Edward, I understand that you want to set up controlled economic experiments in virtual worlds. We discussed earlier some of the possibilities there. Is that what you're hoping to find, how people respond to changes in the economic environment in particular situations?
Yeah, I don't want to go too deeply into academic research methodology, but face it, right now if you wanted to find out how, let's say, a change in the monetary money supply regime or protocols of the Federal Reserve, if you wanted to explore that, you'd either have to come up with a completely abstract theory about how it all works, and there are a lot of limitations to that method. You could look at historical data. You go, well, you know, France did it this way, Germany did it that way, but you're not controlling anything. France and Germany are very, very different. And so you're kind of stuck, or you're left with this sort of blunt empiricism of, well, I've lived in the system for 30 years and now I'm the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, so I know what I'm doing. All three of those have limitations. I'm saying this is a fourth method that's really strongly used in natural sciences where you just set up a controlled experiment. And here you could do that. You'd have these groups of real people interacting in a real economy. It's like, okay, there might be worrying about dragons instead of SUVs, but that's not the critical part. The point is there's currency, there's money supply. And you could play around with policies and protocols almost at will. And just and very simply observe what the outcomes were, what happened. So I think it's a really rich research method. And I expect that what will happen is over the next 20 or 30 years, lots of PhD students in economics, political science, sociology will just start, you know, they'll be savvy with these tools and they'll start building these experiments into their dissertation theses.
And even as they do that, students and professor of law will be watching them closely to try to understand the legal framework in which all of this should happen. David Johnson joins us in the studio. He is a visiting professor of law at New York Law School. David Johnson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The legal framework in which all of this economic activity will be taking place, should there be a new form of regulation to oversee this online economy?
Well, there is already one coming into existence. The avatars are real people, and like real people, they have disputes and sometimes want to have a role in making the rules that govern their activity in the world. They're forming corporations to do business online. They're assaulting each other with imaginary weapons, and partly as a result of the rules set by those who create and own the game space, but also partly as a result of cooperative activity inside the world, they're creating, in effect, a new kind of law.
Who should have the right to control real estate markets or currency exchanges in virtual worlds? Will we soon be seeing legal battles on that front?
Well, we're seeing them now. I guess our American heritage is that the sovereignty belongs to the people. And in the online spaces, you are seeing people from all around the world come together to interact in various ways. One possibility is that every individual country will assert its own rules, but another possibility is that those who are actively engaged together in the online spaces will insist on having a role in making their rules, and governments will largely defer to those rules as long as the rules primarily affect the activities online.
But Philip Rosedale, how about intellectual property? I understand that Second Life gives people intellectual property rights for the things that they create in that virtual world. But how about websites that don't give such rights to users? Philip, first tell me about what you do.
Well, what we do is very explicitly declare that the things that you make in Second Life with your own skills and initiative are things that you own to the greatest extent that we can make that possible. We did that because we believed that allowing people to own their own property, both real estate and the intellectual property associated with their work, was one of the keys to the most rapid growth of the community, growth of the economy that you could get in a virtual world, because it would mirror the countries that historically grew fastest by offering those rights to individuals. So for us, it was kind of a how to grow fastest decision that seemed like a pretty easy one to make.
And Edward Castronova, if you're in fact creating economies of scale like countries and governments like countries in order to test certain conditions, what do you see as the legal framework within which that has to operate?
Well, you know, going back to what I said at the start of the show, we're going to have a conversation about this. I think there's a certain value to having a virtual world exist as sort of an extension of the real world and you know, perhaps take some real world laws and regulations and extend them there. So one could make that case. But by and large, I think these places need to be given special legal recognition. They need to be explicitly considered as separate from the real world because most of their value – well, not most. A substantial portion of what they contributed to humanity comes from the very fact that they are distinct and separate. And so I know it might sound weird to say, well, we'd have a law that sort of, you know, gives some sort of a special protection to this place that could be a place of orcs, or it could be a place out in the galaxy with starships, or it could be a place where people are making themselves into lizards and ogres and so on. It might seem strange to do that, but let's remember corporate law, corporations, are a place where governments have just called into existence fictional people. A corporation is, you know, considered a person, but it's fictional, right? So I think – and there are social and economic reasons for doing that. And I think there are strong social and economic reasons for us to just recognize these places as fantasy places with their own special rights and responsibilities, which would include what David is talking about, you know, setting up their own legal systems. And Philip saying, you know, they have their own property rights within them and the people there are free to determine their society as they would.
Well, you heard it, David. Edward is just saying that we need to have a conversation about how to do this. You know, in Washington, we either have disagreements or lawsuits. We don't really have conversations at all. Are we likely to see a lot of lawsuits developing out of things like intellectual property rights?
Well, there have been many lawsuits, but we'll also see ways of resolving disputes. Domain names, for example, now involve many disputes that are resolved under something called the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy, which provides a rapid global arbitration with regard to intellectual property rights. In addition, in virtual worlds, there's a new kind of property called that I call digital property. The software code itself can be set to control what can be done with your object. You can create a lock on the door to your virtual house, for example, which doesn't require a legal system. And also in response to Ted, I don't think there'll be just one regime. He said earlier that this may become a platform for many different kinds of activity, including real governmental activities. So New York Law School students now are building something they call Democracy Island to try to improve on the way people participate in rulemaking for the federal government. So I think you'll see many different sets of rules and many different ways of interacting.
I agree with that,
actually. Let's go to that as well.
Let's go to the telephones. Here is Josh in Washington, D.C. Josh, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I have a question about a phenomena called Chinese farmers, and I understand that they're not really Chinese. What they really are is Korean families that are supporting themselves by playing video games and selling the money on eBay. Specifically in Lineage 2 and World of Warcraft, this seems to be very popular.
Know anything about that, David?
Well, I especially in games where there's an advantage in gaining special weapons or tools, there has been a tendency for some people to sell those digital properties. Ted is the real expert on this. And sometimes the game owners have frowned on it and tried to shut it down. But ultimately, an online space belongs to the people who inhabit it.
Edward Castronova?
Yeah, what's going on is there's an industry growing up that's leveraging the differentiation in global wages. It's unfair to say, well, there are these Chinese gold farmers, but let's just start with that phrase. Where does it emerge from? A gold farmer is somebody who goes into a virtual world and doesn't really play the game and just does whatever it takes to get gold. So it might involve killing the same monster over and over again and always taking that monster's treasure. And I think the slur Chinese has been applied because there's this feeling that it's primarily low-wage labor countries. And the evidence that's emerging about this does indicate that that is the case. So, you know, certainly Asia, but also Eastern Europe. And what's interesting is this is becoming a regular sort of corporate activity. There are corporations that are growing up around just the idea of, well, we're going to have, you know, 3,000 employees who do nothing but sit in front of computers all day farming these worlds for gold. We'll sell it on eBay. We keep the proceeds and pay those guys $1 an hour. It's a classic case of the globalization of labor markets, actually, and I think it's really fascinating.
Josh, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead, Philip.
You know, if I could just add a thought about that I think Second Life brings to light, which I have found fascinating, which is we often in this talking about online games talk about it as perhaps a bit exploitive. You know, people are paying their bills by logging hours basically in a virtual world. But if you think about it, we had Chip on before. Second Life is a mostly North American audience at this point. The majority of people are from there. And therefore, they're willing to pay $16 for an article of clothing or a skin. Imagine for a moment that Second Life is global. We have users from 100 countries. There's nothing that keeps someone in China or India as a young artist from jumping in and setting up a shop right next to Chip and selling pieces of clothing for $16 competitively. Now, I think that actually reverses the argument a little bit, since $16 US taken on into a PayPal account and converted to local currency is quite a bit of money in those countries.
David Johnson, I wanted to get back to one legal issue that some people think might be troubling, the legal issue surrounding sexual harassment. Does it make any difference if a person who is being harassed looks nothing like their avatar?
Well, I think Second Life, for example, has rules against assaulting another avatar. So the general need for rules to keep bad action under control will persist. It does become a bit confusing to determine to use traditional concepts in these online worlds because they're so different, and that's really one reason why they will begin to develop rules of their own.
Here's John in Washington, D.C. John, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo. Once again, great program. However, I do think that all of your callers and all of your and all of your guests are actually marginalizing the video gaming aspect of this. I mean, I can understand that, you know, you have several thousand or maybe even tens of thousands of people who are on this one server that you guys are talking about, Second Life. But you have to understand that there are millions and millions and millions of other people playing these other games. And that's where the bulk of the actual economy comes from. And what's really interesting about it is that I think that you probably would have been better served having someone from World of Warcraft or Star Wars Galaxies on, because it also opens up...
Been there, done that.
but just for example, there was an incident that happened in Korea where someone was actually killed over one of these games.
Well, as I said, been there, done that. We've discussed that before. What we wanted specifically to look at on this occasion is virtual worlds, because the argument has been made that what's being created here is an entire society and that it is indeed much more than a game. But, John, thank you very much for your call. One more call. Tim, could you keep your question or comment brief? We're running out of time.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on, you know, my experience and interaction in virtual online worlds, Second Life, and there, and how that affected my, you know, my real world interaction with people.
How did it?
I'm not a shy person particularly, but I'm also not the kind of person who would, you know, engage in a conversation in a public place with a perfect stranger without, you know, something to kind of urge me on. And in Second Life and there, you end up having to do that a lot. I mean, if you want to understand the world, you've got to talk to people.
So have your social skills, in your view, improved?
Well, I don't know if I'd say they've improved, but they've taken a new direction. You know, I have on a number of occasions now, something I never would have done before, is go and talk to people in real life, interact with them, and not allow the fear of rejection, which happens so often in real life interactions.
I'm afraid I'm about to encourage that fear right now, because we've got to go, Tim, because we're running out of time, but we're not rejecting you. David Johnson is visiting professor of law at New York Law School. Edward Castronova is a professor of telecommunications at Indiana University. Philip Rosedale is founder and CEO of Linden Lab, that developed SecondLife.com. Thank you all for joining us. I'm Kojo Namdi.